You've written down some questions and you want to kind of wave your hand a little bit so that Beth can come around and pick those up and we can read those to the panelists. But I'll just start with a couple. We know that our suicide statistics are alarming in Montana, and so I'll just kind of put this out to each of the panelists, but Dr. Asterson might be able to tell us how MSU engages in suicide prevention on campus or in the university system. I think Dr. Scott might be able to tell us kind of what school community partnerships could have an impact on related to suicide in communities. And then if any other panelists have some thoughts on our high suicide rate and what some strategies might be.
Okay, so I can start. Within the college population, excuse me, we know suicide is certainly something we take very seriously, and we invest a lot of resources into suicide prevention efforts. We had a SAMHSA Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Act grant probably 7 years ago that really helped us move into a more comprehensive approach to suicide prevention. So at this point at MSU, we have developed a comprehensive suicide prevention plan, which includes things like gatekeeper training and training for faculty and staff, residents like staff, all of those folks who might be the first folks to notice someone who might be at risk. How do you have clinical services involved? The counseling center is a part of that. We've done a lot of work on means reduction. We know that's a really significant suicide prevention strategy, where if you can limit a person's access to lethal means in a suicidal crisis, they're very unlikely to change means. So if you can limit their access, that's critical. So we have a centralized weapons storage facility here on campus now, which we didn't previously have. We can work to store weapons and other methods of means over there, as well as prescription drop boxes across campus, so people who might want to dispose of medications. We know in our population, our suicide surveillance data really shows us that overdose is our top means that people use for attempting. I will say, in Montana, one of our greatest challenges with suicide prevention is access to firearms, because we know that's such a lethal mean, and that continues to be the top means of completion in the state. So that's something that we talk about here in terms of gun locks and different ways for people to effectively store firearms and limit their access to that during a suicidal crisis. So those are some of the things that we're doing. I'll let others jump into.
Yeah, I can jump in real quick. So one of the things that Montana, especially MSU, has an advantage of is we have an extension agency as part of MSU. And so one thing that we have done is to partner not only with the schools throughout the state, but also to partner with those extension agents in those communities. Because the truth is, the schools are overburdened as it is. Teachers are, some of them, as you said earlier, don't even have counselors that are available. And if they do, they're basically having to counsel to the whole school, and that's, you know, kindergarten all the way through 12th grade. So we're trying to find solutions that do not involve any more burden on the administration, staff, or the teachers. And one way that we found that with the Youth Aware Mental Health Program, or YAM, was to actually involve extension agents and train them as facilitators. And we've done that with several of these agents across the state. The great thing about that, too, is that is part of their job anyways, and they're already pretty much paid for that. And so it's sustainable in that way to provide these services. The other thing that I just want to kind of touch on is that adolescents, particularly Montana, is much higher in the suicide rates than the rest of the country. And so, you know, again, it's not even about prevention. It's actually about early intervention. To prevent suicidal attempts and suicide completions within our adolescent population and possibly even younger kids as well. And so programs like the YAM program, one of the reasons that we went with it was that it teaches a couple of things within the school system. And we actually implement it within the health class, which makes sense because it's not just physical health, it's important, it's also mental health. And as part of that program, they learn about what is suicide, what's depression, what are some other risk factors. They also learn coping mechanisms and a way that they can actually deal with some of the feelings they have. But I think the biggest part of that is starting to understand how it looks in others and asking the questions for your peers, how are you feeling today, right? What's going on in your life? Can you talk about that? And whenever they do identify some of these things, it's okay to go to a coach, to a teacher, to the counselor, principal, and tell them, we think that you may need to talk to the student because this is some of the issues that they kind of bring up, or this is the type of behavior they've been engaging in and the way they're thinking. And it also provides for those students who are having those suicidal ideations knowledge of who they can go to, and they can actually ask questions and who they might feel comfortable with. The last piece of that, which is extremely important as well, is during this program, they role play. And so they get to act out these different scenarios of actually talking to their peers or talking to authority figures that they may not normally want to talk to. And so we've seen, you know, quite a bit of success. We still have not, I would say, fully tested that program here in Montana. It's actually developed in Sweden and tested in Europe. It's still kind of under investigation here in the United States, and we're partnered with people from Baltimore, as well as other places in Texas across the country that are implementing these programs to see how well we can adapt it for these rural communities, and also to partner with the schools. The schools is it's a nice place to start because you have all the kids there, for one thing, and we do know that with some families, they're so overburdened or stressed that to try to bring the parents in or them to go one-on-one therapy can be extremely difficult. And so being able to kind of interject at the school level in a place that they're all at and provide them with those resources is extremely important.
Okay, so we have some questions from the audience. And the first is a series of questions about addiction. So I'm going to see what Dr. Seitz has to say. Is drug addiction risk inherited? That's the first part. Is addiction hard to treat if it starts at a younger age? And then what drugs are hardest to quit if addicted?
So I'd love to actually have some sort of dynamic back and forth with whoever's asking the question or which table. It sounds like a committee. So what I think I can do is, by way of explanation, address ideally at least two of these questions, and then whoever wants to can keep me honest into answering the third. Certainly, generally speaking, substance use disorders within psychiatry are one of the more straightforward things to treat. Big secret. I dare say that within the last 2 years, I have heard a medical provider say, quote, "I don't treat addicts." And this was at one of the largest hospitals in the state. And, you know, I hear that and I'm left wondering, okay, is there stigma aversion? Like a sense of disgust, kind of similar to what some of us may experience when we think we're confronted with something that COVID-19 is going to infect us, especially the pre-vaccination world, what that experience was like. And that's a really strong drive within us, by the way, disgust. Is it fear of being inadequate to treat substance use disorders? Is it something entirely else that I just don't understand? And I think part of what we've struggled with as a medical society, and I'm going to focus on physicians, nurse practitioners, because really, I'm one of them. So, you know, it's like being, I was raised Catholic. As a Catholic, you can say certain things about Catholics that you wouldn't dare say about other religions. It just doesn't make any darn sense. Simply put, within psychiatry, substance use disorders are one of the more straightforward things to treat. And remarkably, here's the big secret, and selfishly, this is why I chose to subspecialize in addiction psychiatry. On a whole, the prognosis tends to be better. Psychiatry can be heartbreaking. It can be heartbreaking to work in a mental health center in which you treat people with severe treatment refractory depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and a likelihood of a return to pre-morbid level of function, how that person was before schizophrenia prodrome. We're not there yet. perhaps in the near future, the next 20 years, thanks to the work of people here on this panel, with my colleague Dr. Kushner had identified, we'll get to a place where that will be the case. But what's cool right here, in 2023, Montana, for many substance use disorders, we're already there. We're already there for opioid use disorder. And it's kind of a sideways answer to one of the questions. That is both the easiest and the hardest substance use disorder to treat. It's the easiest because, very similar to treatment of diabetes, we have interventions that work remarkably well to keep patients alive. And if there's one thing that really matters in all the work we do, it's patient safety. And in teaching resident physicians, I always emphasize safety and rapport. If you just focus on that in the initial encounter, you've done all right. If the patient hates you, you're done. You're not coming back. If you don't ensure safety, well, Hippocratic Oath, basic is keep the patient alive, avoid harm. And if we think about how we can apply those core principles of treatment of opioid use disorder using medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, MOUD, one of three, and generally it tends to be the first, buprenorphine, Suboxone, Vivitrol, or Methadone, if someone who has moderate to severe opioid use disorder does not receive one of those three treatments, they have a 10% annual death rate. That's it. And we know, following that cohort long-term, 2-3 years out, if they don't have access to treatment, 95% likelihood of return to use. And that return to use is incredibly dangerous because oftentimes people go back to using the same dose of illicit opioids they were using prior to abstaining. They no longer have the tolerance, overdose, and in some cases die. So that's a really big deal. Yet here in the state of Montana, we have a lot of sober facilities. And I'll tell you, with the work I do with the Rimrock Foundation, I've had to make calls to the directors of sober facilities, places of disposition from discharge from Rimrock that don't accept patients on MOUD. How does that go?
Yes.
And that's one of the things we face. So I'd say it's the easiest and the hardest. And it's worth highlighting that the MOUD keeps patients alive. The true recovery process, and I think something that is consistent and congruent with mutual help groups, 12-step, AA, NA model, is the recovery, the return to function that we all want for our loved ones who have substance use disorders. That takes engagement in chemical dependency counseling, motivational interviewing, in some cases, contingency management. I'm going to stop because we've got a lot more questions.
Okay, I'm going to ask a question of Dr. Kushner, and it is, how close are we to blood test diagnostics for mental health disorders?
Thanks for that. This question is a great question. Well, I think, you know, this was a bit what I was alluding to before, which is that I think we're getting very close to having a panel that all people with psychiatric disorders should be screened for, because they would highlight potentially medically actionable forms of mental illness. Now, in many mental health centers, that's already done for a limited panel, right now. There's, for instance, screening for markers of syphilis, which historically was, a condition that was much more common than it is now, fortunately, and could present with various psychiatric symptoms, particularly prominently for people with psychotic illness, and was, really medically actionable, with antibiotics. We now generally screen for people with, depressive or mood symptoms for changes in their thyroid function. But I would expect that, in the coming decade, particularly, that we're going to see that panel of blood tests that are relatively inexpensive that will be available to be able to screen much more broadly for potentially medically actionable forms of illness. And, in my remarks earlier, I was referring to a lot of inflammatory and immunologic conditions And I think we're going to see much more of that. You know, there's a variety of autoimmune disorders that really can present, you know, in a very classic, you know, forms that, you know, turn out to be something that we don't want to miss. And so I think, you know, the short answer is, I think it's not too far off that we're going to be able to start doing that and catching more and more people who, you know, we're able to give more definitive treatment than is possible now.
Thank you. So I have a series of questions here that are about Indigenous mental health, Indigenous students, and what provisions we might make to support their mental health while they're on campus. And then what about the support for or existence of practitioners who are Indigenous? And so I'll just throw that question out. I think maybe a few of you might have some comments on, we're talking about student mental health, we're talking about the preparation of mental health practitioners who are from Indigenous communities, and any particular issues that you have noticed in your work?
How would you start with the students? College.
Yeah, I'll start just a little bit about kind of our work here on campus. I mean, I think our partnership with our colleagues in the American Indian Alaska Native Student Success Center has been critical for us in terms of trying to understand and be thoughtful about our cultural sensitivity and cultural humility and engaging in our work with Native and Indigenous students. One of our main goals, honestly, has been to hire a therapist who identifies as Indigenous. We've heard that message loud and clear, and we had one who, for personal reasons, had to depart last year. And that was really, I think, important for us in understanding the importance of representation and the importance of identity and the importance of really hearing the needs of that population on campus. The ways that currently we work with our Native and Indigenous students is we co-host a weekly talking circle in their space and really follow the lead of our colleagues over there about what that looks like and what they want from us in terms of mental health support. We do drop-in counseling hours over in American Indian Hall, knowing that for many of our Indigenous students, they would prefer to access those services in a space that feels comfortable and more like home to them. And then also we know we have a lot of Indigenous students who might prefer not to do that, and so how can they access services in the ways that make sense for them, whether that's coming to the counseling center, using telehealth, whatever that might look like. The other things I think have been important for us is partnering in just being a part of the community as best we can. So whether that's Missing Murdered and Indigenous Peoples Day is next week, and we have some activities on campus and partnering with our colleagues in how we support those activities. Not that they're that it's showing up and being there in the community in some way and really listening to what their needs are. And lastly, I guess I would say, is really incorporating that feedback and listening to what they want and need for mental health care. And sometimes that means helping connect them with providers elsewhere. If they're looking for a service that we can't provide, or they're wanting an Indigenous counselor with a specific area of specialty, how we can support and helping to connect them with those resources elsewhere in the state, if that makes sense for them, and really trying to honor the needs that they might have in the intersection of their intersecting identities and what that might mean for mental health.
Thank you. Sorry to throw that on you. You can answer college students first. My experience with students here at MSU that are Native and Indigenous has been a little bit limited. However, I did have the honor of working with what's called our Bridges Program, where Indigenous students from different reservations throughout the state come here during the summer. I believe it's for 6 weeks to 8 weeks to actually stay on campus. They attend courses or small classes while they're here. And then they also work with mentors or professors across the university in whatever field of interest that they have. And the hopes is that they will register for the fall semester after that summer is done. I actually have hosted a couple of students, and one thing I've noticed, especially with one of my students, was that transition from the reservation to Bozeman, to Montana State. Coming from a college that is on the reservation, they're typically two-year colleges. One of the things that she talked about was, even though she had this small cohort during the summer, when she transitioned to the fall, she felt very isolated, like she didn't really belong because she was one of the few Indigenous or Native students in her classes. And so it wasn't that she wasn't provided with certain support systems throughout the university, but it was just that belongingness and feeling like she didn't belong here compared to where she came from. Another thing, we had a panel a few years ago that the Center for American Indian Health, Rural Health Equity had with Indigenous students. And one of the things that they all talked about was this kind of lack of confidence in their ability to achieve academically when they came here. And this kind of goes to your question about practitioners. In terms of Indigenous practitioners, is that sometimes they don't, you know, because of the kind of lack of confidence, a lot of them may not feel like they can go for the master's or for the PhD to get these advanced degrees. And then also, how will they belong when they come back? In my conversations with certain individuals that have left the reservation and came back, you talk about predators in your nation, there actually is that they experience because they're the outsiders now. They're the ones who left and when they got these fancy degrees, and now they're coming back to the community. And how do they fit in and belong to that community now? So they kind of don't fit in either world, right? And how do we navigate that? That becomes the question. I don't think we have an answer right now for how we do that. I think we're trying our best to figure that out. And one of my colleagues in our department, Dr. John Henderson, that is what her research is. She works on the Blackfeet community, nation, and essentially is trying to understand belongingness and loneliness. But she's also working with college students, not just here, but other places, to understand that transition and how loneliness and belongingness can really impact not only their mental health, but their physical health as well, and their production or performance in school. So, you know, the other piece of this, I actually work with, or beginning to work with, a colleague from the Navajo Nation, Dr. Calvin White. His son actually lives here in Bozeman and is also a person who helped me get into the community and work with the Indigenous communities. But he is a licensed counseling psychologist. He's worked in Utah, he's worked in Arizona. And one of the things he talked about with me personally a few weeks ago was essentially, you know, when he was getting his doctorate degree and he was going through his internship, these practicums at the University of Utah, he actually got suspended because he was using traditional ways of healing, such as smudging, and they said, you can't do that, right? Because that's not how we do it as a counseling or clinical psychologist. There are certain things that you can and can't do, and they made him stop doing that. What he found funny is 20 years later, he goes back and guess what they're doing? They're smudging and they're praying and they're doing these other things that are more traditional, right? And I think one of the things that I've learned working with this particular community and other Indigenous communities throughout the state is that there is scientific knowledge that we do here at the university as a Western perspective, but there's also Indigenous knowledge. And Dr. St. Pierre, he passed away a few years ago, but he used to actually be in charge of the Native American Studies here at MSU, went back to Stone Child College at Rocky Boy. And one of the things that he told us, me and this other researcher in this conference we had, was that just because things have not been proven in Western scientific knowledge does not mean that they don't work. And that he said, his exact words, we know it works, because it's our knowledge, and it's been working for thousands of years. We don't need you to tell us whether something works or doesn't work. And that I'll end with this, but essentially that kind of came full circle when I met a gentleman, Kenny Smoker, who works at the Fort Peck Reservation. And he's done some great work up there with interventions in the sense that he uses these traditional ways of knowledge and also healing to help his youth. And one of those main programs is archery. So he took, you know, about 15 years ago, 10 years ago, he took a group of kids who had a lot of behavior problems in school, and he taught them how to shoot arrows and to be part of archery. Now they win state tournaments across Montana and outside of Montana. But as I started to have this conversation with him about what he did, I started to figure out that all the components of cognitive behavioral therapy that we know are evidence-based for anxiety, depression, behavior problems, all these other issues that people tend to have, and youth particularly, he was using those components. He was just doing it in such a way that it made sense for their culture and for their tradition. And as we had that conversation, I was like, okay, the cognitive piece is they learn how to fail, but then they pick up the arrow and they try again, and they keep doing it, right? And even if they do have, which we do, natural anxiety, I always tell people, anxiety's not bad. We're supposed to have anxiety. It's just when it becomes chronic and intense. And I was like, you're dealing with that and you're handling it away. And so you're reinforcing these behaviors of approach that keep them from getting into trouble or engaging in behaviors or having that anxiety and depression that they may experience. And unfortunately, what has happened with indigenous populations in terms of research is we just haven't tested it. We haven't gathered the data. And so that's one of the things that I'm working with Rocky Point, hopefully expand to other tribes, is to actually show that some of these indigenous ways of doing things work just as well, if not better, than Western ways. And I'll stop there.
Can I just add one thing? It's kind of a nice segue to what you're saying. I think with the grant that we have, the Girl Mental Health Preparation Practice Pathway Grant, the whole focus of that grant, especially with the second round of funding, is to bring individuals from their communities to school. Like, hopefully they're interested in coming to get that training and then go back to their community. And the funding allows them the mechanism to be able to potentially do that. And I will say also, like, in our, and I say this for our counseling training program, but I think this is going to be true for a lot of training programs across Montana and some of our states and the Rocky Mountain West particularly, are looking at alternative ways to deliver education, to be flexible. We've had to be flexible in our training program with students who are out in communities and they can't make it in for class. Fortunately, one thing we learned through COVID is we can Zoom, and we can Zoom people in for class, and we can get creative about how we still deliver that material when, in that instance, they're not able to come. And so I think that's also another really important aspect of this issue that we're talking about, is providing those mechanisms, providing the opportunities, providing a way for those individuals to be able to come, get the training, and then go back to their community and be able to deliver help in that way.
So I have another question for Dr. Kushner, actually two, and then you can reflect on both of these. The first is how psychiatric illness interacts with other vital organs. So that's one. And then the second is, if your child develops symptoms of schizophrenia, what could you recommend as an idea to protect their brain?
Thank you. These are great questions. Let me start with the first. I think one of the really, really fascinating emerging areas in the brain sciences, and I mean this beyond psychiatry really fundamentally, is exactly the question that you're asking, which is how the brain interacts with the rest of the body. I'll give one example of a recent example that's come from the field, and I think we're going to hear a lot more about it. Many of us have had the remarkable experience to see people at the end of their life and have had the feeling that people's motivation or some sense of their will to live really can inspire the body to be able to persevere and have extraordinary resilience. It doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, that's sufficient to overcome disease, but when you talk about, you know, fighting through, we talk, you know, in this, you know, sort of colloquial parlance, we talk about, you know, fighting a disease, like, you know, fighting cancer. There's a recent study that was done that the results are just so compelling, and these have been, you know, to contrast with the earlier thing that I said, these have already been replicated. There's a lot of reason to believe this is very, very likely true. If it turns out that, you know, there's that our brain is just so extraordinarily organized. There's one particular area in our brain that really controls the extent to which we experience pleasure, happiness. It's one of the motivating areas. It's, you know, it's in the ventral midbrain where we, you know, derive a lot of motivation and will to do a lot of things. And it turns out that artificially stimulating that area there's data, this is work that's done in animals, but there's ways that potentially this is now going to be extended to humans. If you stimulate these areas, that actually the ability to fight off diseases and even cancer has been shown to be remarkable. That simply driving the motivation centers in the brain have the capacity to endow the rest of our body with an additional resilience as well. And that really, you know, that makes a lot of sense. For example, you know, there's a wealth of epidemiologic data showing that, for example, for people with depression, that, you know, just getting up and going and doing exercise and, you know, already that those kinds of things can be, you know, very, very helpful for treatment or, you know, engaging in social activities. So I think we're going to hear a lot more about it, but the bottom line is I think we know enough to know already that the answer to that question is yes, there is a very powerful control that is exerted by the brain, probably in both directions, for good and, you know, and for less good, you know, depending on what our states are. And, you know, earlier, you know, there were conversations about, you know, substance use, and I think there's a lot more that we have to discover about that relationship, and it's probably very profound. I think the second question had to do with how it is that we might think about prevention strategies for disorders like schizophrenia. And I will say one in particular. There's a number, you know, some of them I think more general, but I do want to point out one because I think it really goes to the heart of probably a lot of biology, and it's also a very, very what we would call modifiable risk factor. So I'll tell another quick anecdote, which is if you go back about 15 years or so, the medical journal, The Lancet, which is a very, very highly regarded, you know, medical journal, it's out of London. It's sort of, you know, the American equivalent, the British equivalent of the New England Journal of Medicine. They weighed in on a lot of the controversy around, you know, cannabis and marijuana and how, you know, around the world, different governments were, you know, thinking about how to deal with this. And about 15 years ago, their opinion was that for them, there was no conclusive data that suggested that smoking marijuana was really a significant medical or psychiatric problem. And a few years later, they wrote, these were the editors, the editors wrote essentially a retraction where they said, you know, we go back and we are going to now correct ourselves. We think we're wrong. And that was because, you know, there was increasing data which over the last, you know, 10 years has only increased further and is something that I think is really relevant because a lot of states are changing their policies about this. Very recently, New York did. And that is that during a critical period, what we call a critical period of development, which is essentially, you know, sort of the teenage years, that for those individuals who are predisposed, and that's probably, you know, very much determined, you know, genetically, that they have a liability to develop schizophrenia. So it doesn't mean that that's definite. It just means that they're at higher risk. That if they're, you know, they have more stressful life experiences or they have certain environmental exposures, that they have a higher liability to develop schizophrenia, that cannabis use during adolescence is a very, very high risk thing to do for those individuals. And this actually relates to the sort of the earlier question that was asked, which is, you know, about risk factors and blood tests and things like that. We know, of course, that the vast majority of teenagers who use cannabis, the vast, vast majority will not develop schizophrenia. But we also know that the subset that has high genetic liability for that, that could be almost deterministic for them. That's really for them, you know, like playing, you know, to use the term Russian roulette for them. And so as we start to develop more insight into the biology, I think we're going to see more and more blood tests where it's going to be possible to determine people's relative risk levels, you know, what their liability is. And for those individuals who are at higher liability in particular, we'll be able to advise them, you know, very strongly that's something that they probably particularly shouldn't be doing. But I will say right now, until those tests, you know, exist, that is one example of something that at least during that age range, you know, for some subset of kids, that's a really, really serious thing. And our best proxy for that right now is family history. So I can say, you know, for any of you who have a significant family history of psychotic disorders and, you know, things like bipolar disorder, because the genetic correlation is very high, or, you know, certainly schizophrenia, you know, for those teenagers in your family who have those relatives, this is a really, really bad idea to be using cannabis during, you know, adolescence. There's a lot of other examples. That's one, you know, in particular I'd like to highlight again, because a lot of states are changing their policies, but the point is really well taken that, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on diagnosis and treatment, but let's not forget that prevention is probably the most cost-effective, you know, and most ethical intervention of all that we can make.
Thank you so much. Okay, a couple questions for Dr. Seiss. One of our local community mental health advocates has stated that caring for addiction disorder ought to be our highest priority in addressing our community's mental health care. What do you think? And then there's another question, maybe related to what Dr. Christian was just talking about. Are there opportunities for using magic mushrooms as treatment by a guided therapist or a trained therapist who has attachment with the patient? I'll let you reflect on those.
Yeah, so I'll start off with the second question. So it's about the use of psilocybin, and fairly undifferentiated, what can we do with it, and specifically, is there value therapeutically of using it as part of a therapeutic engagement? More and more research is coming into the academic sphere. John Hopkins has a center dedicated to psychedelics research in psychiatry. UW is trying to launch a center. Increasingly, we're seeing there's a lot of promise for the use of psilocybin, and this is not microdosing. We're talking a one-time heroic dose of psilocybin, something like Timothy Leary would recommend and condone. Remarkably, if you look at the outcomes for treatment of alcohol use disorder, it was either the 3 or the 6 month, but regardless, quite clinically significant. The rates of abstinence in the medium term, just following a one-time heroic dose of psilocybin, were quite good. And we are seeing applications for the use of psilocybin in the treatment of major depression. Few thoughts. One rate-limiting factor in getting this released for public consumption so that we can see it here in Bozeman available, say, by 2026, 2027, the business model's not great. If you think about the cost of psilocybin, magic mushrooms, anyone can grow them. And if we're talking about just 3 doses in 3 supervised sessions, the total value associated with that economically is way less than someone being on a serotonergic antidepressant indefinitely. So there's not, there hasn't been a lot of FDA-approved studies in this space. We hope that the academic centers will continue to pursue this. Some in a related application of a psychedelic there is a push to get MDMA approved by the FDA for treatment of PTSD. So we are seeing some advances in this space. It's compelling. And not to belabor it, the reset we see in the use of psychedelics insofar as how the brain functions is quite relevant and has meaningful clinical outcomes, in particular psilocybin for major depression, alcohol use disorder. The first question I'm going to ask for a reminder what that dealt with.
Yes, one of our local community mental health
Addiction's king. I mean, I'm an addiction psychiatrist. What do you want me to say? This is, you're pandering to me. Is it by far and away the thing to focus on for Gallatin County? I'd really like Gallatin County to have a robust mental health crisis response system. And I know many people in the room have worked tirelessly to make that happen, and we need to continue to advocate for that. Within it, embedded in a core service offering, has to be substance use disorder treatment, as so often that's part of the crisis. So I'd say within that context, it is quite compelling.
Thank you. So a question for Dr. Asterson, and it's about the new student health center on campus. And could you talk about what additional opportunities or services that new facility might help you offer on campus?
Yeah, it's very exciting that we're bringing all of the wellness services together under one roof out of the unfortunate incident of the roof collapses on the gyms, which luckily no one was injured. So that what has come out of that is this really great opportunity to try to address health and well-being in one setting. So on one part of the building, it will be the new fitness centers and all of the physical activities, but we'll also have our medical clinic. Counseling will be in that building, health advancement, which focuses on prevention and education, Bounty of the Bridgers, which is our food pantry, as well as our pharmacy, lab, and x-ray. So already I would say one of the benefits that we've seen about bringing all of these services together is some of what we're talking about, like how do we connect the education to the treatment, to the ways of well-being that we know make a difference in prevention and people sort of finding the support that they need. So having all of these spaces together, I think, will make a big difference in helping us take that more collaborative approach. As for us specifically, it's going to allow us to expand our groups program, our outreach programs, drop-in spaces. We're going to have a wonderful space to do. We do mindfulness groups right now, but to really expand that and have more space to integrate movement, mindfulness, all of that into the different treatments that we can offer, as well as spaces where we will be able to smudge in the new wellness center. And we're excited about that. That was an intentional piece of how do we build a building that sort of helps us embody more of that inclusive approach.
Thank you. So I think what I'll do now is I have two more questions. One's more specific and one is more general. And I'd just like to give each of the panelists a chance to either reflect on one of those or to just share something that you have been thinking about that we haven't talked about yet that you'd really like to bring to our awareness. So I'll just read the questions and you can think about them for a minute and then we can just kind of launch into these closing remarks. So the first is, how will artificial intelligence be integrated into mental health treatment? Second one is, in your experience, how do you measure success? So it could be in preparation of professionals, it could be in working with students, it could be in working communities, work with patients, work in practice, just how do you measure success? How do you know when you tell someone? Okay, so I'll just say this again while you're thinking. Artificial intelligence, how will that be integrated into mental health treatment? And then the second is about measuring success. You want to get started? Exercise?
Happy to jump in. So a few years ago, a group based out of Stanford launched Robot. It was a then kind of state-of-the-art AI-empowered CBT chatbot. And the Stanford students who used it, this was 2017, 2018, appreciated it. And there's some meaningful data. Now, for those of you who may be aware, with ChatGPT-4, And playing that with that myself the other night, I was like, wow, I can never assign like a take-home essay to any medical students with me and anticipate that, sure, you won't use this. I mean, I'd use it if I were a student now. Increasingly, I think we can see that some level of engagement can be enhanced with artificial intelligence. If we use it right, it's going to extend the work that we're currently doing. Of course, some business models may push it in a direction where it is replacing contact with a clinician and very much the detriment of the patient, because as much as we want ChatGPT-4 to be able to do empathic reflections, make comments informed by the DSM, it ain't there. And if you look to where the machine scientists are betting, they're saying it's not even close within the next 5 years, maybe 10, we'll see. But living in the moment and addressing the second question, success for us at 406 Recovery is number of patients treated, and focusing specifically on substance use disorders, abstinence rates of non-use of illicit substances at 6, 12, 18 months, and as another very compelling outcome, survival. Because we do practice harm reduction, and for some patients, they're not seeking abstinence, and our ability to remain engaged with them, keep them active in treatment, and keep them alive is so meaningful. And if you look at the results in treatment of opioid use disorder, the vast majority of people end up abstinent from illicit opioids if they stay in treatment long enough, even if they weren't seeking abstinence to begin with.
I'll follow that up. If we have the ability for AI, I will be out of a job. I train people and counselors. But I think seriously, though, the relationship piece that you've spoke to as well, I mean, that element is an important part of the work that we do. I certainly have been fascinated today by hearing about the work of Dr. Kushner and others at this table. And it's inspiring. But I don't think we're ever going to be able to step away from the fact that when we sit with someone and we're face-to-face and we have a relationship with them, change happens. So I think for me, when I think about success, I spoke to that number, and that's one marker of success. We have people persisting in rural communities, and for me, with my work, that's an important part. Like, that was our whole reason for wanting to do this work, was to try to move the dial a bit on how many practitioners we have in rural communities. But I think the real number that is a measure of success for our work is, in the state of Montana, 10% of youth attempt suicide. That's not ideation, that's attempt of suicide. And until we start to see that number come down, we need to have more practitioners out in those rural communities, because when you get out to the rural communities, that number moves up. And I think until we start getting more practitioners out there, until we start getting more into the workforce, and then we start seeing that number come down, for me, that's the real measure of success, is that we're impacting lives, and that we're providing prevention through programs like the young. And so it's not just that work. We need all of this work at the table in order to move that dial.
Yeah, I guess I'm the next follow-up. I agree with both my colleagues up here in terms of AI and that human component being missing. As I was sitting here, I was reflecting on my first couple years of my PhD program when the Xbox Kinect came out. And the early commercials, I was so excited because the early commercials, they presented this game that essentially this boy or girl could essentially read your emotions and react to your emotions and learn from your emotions, right? And MIT has done a lot of studies on emotion recognition and having AI to actually do this, but they haven't been quite successful in terms they can recognize your emotion. But responding to that and learning essentially how you're going to respond and how they should properly respond and having that connection is just still missing. And in fact, that game, by the way, never came out. And probably the reason was because it was going to be a failure from the beginning. They weren't able to do what they promised to do or showed you that they could do. And so Yeah, I don't know. We've had conversations within our department, I would say within the last month, not only from a teaching perspective, but also from a psychological perspective and even a mental health therapy perspective, of how is this going to help us advance the field, but also how is it going to thwart the field as well and kind of push us back in some ways if we tend to rely on AI particularly. That's all I have to really say about that. I haven't thought about it for probably the last month. The other part, like measuring success, for me, that's really hard. I can't put a number on it, right? I can't quantify what I consider to be success, right? Is it 30% less children experiencing anxiety and depression than currently do? That would be great, but I don't know if that's possible in this moment. Hopefully it is in the future. For me, especially working with kids, is that they start to understand what anxiety is, what depression is, what emotions or thoughts and behaviors are driving that, that causes it to be more chronic, that causes it to be more intense, and how can they help from it ever becoming to that point, or if it already is at that point, what can they do to manage those emotions that they're experiencing? How can they regulate those things? And so for me, if they can start to build those tools in their toolbox and put those in there, and I just put a lot of tools in their toolbox. I always say this because I've heard that it's like, well, the more strategies they have, the better off they are. So, I mean, if you use a screwdriver and you need a hammer, it's not going to work very well, right? You just can't do it. So not only having those tools, but also knowing when to properly use those tools to help them feel less anxious and depressed. And I also come from a kind of perspective of accepting. It's okay to feel anxious. It's okay to feel sad and depressed. We all do at some point in our lives. It's when that happens, is to validate it, experience it, and then learn how to manage it, which is what these two ladies up here do great with, of helping them do that. But that's my hope for my research, and for me, that's what success is. It's just that they have the knowledge, and they're starting to at least build those strengths to get to that point.
I'm going to take a pass on AI. I don't know. I'd be curious to see what happens, but I don't have much to add on that particular point. But in reflecting on success, I mean, I think there are many ways we do that in terms of measuring outcomes. Like, we're watching our data. Are their symptoms getting better? We benchmark that, and we look, are we tracking with others? We do client evaluations. What's their feedback to us? I use all of those sources of data, and our team does that to try to understand how we're doing. That's important, but honestly, when I think about the success and the way we talk about that within CPS, we think about when students reach back out to us 5 years later, and they say, wow, that thing that I really worked on with you has made a difference in my life, and now I'm able to do the things I want to do. It's the things that happen in the walls, sitting one-on-one with a person week after week after week, that really is the thing that I think our staff and that I take the most pride in, because that's why we all started to do this work. COVID hit, and it was wonderful that we could do telehealth, and everyone thought, wow, students are gonna wanna keep doing telehealth. Why would they wanna come in? That's not even close to being true. All of our students want to come in, and they want to sit in a room with a person. That gives me hope about the connections that we have for the future. And the other thing I would say is really, I don't know that this is a measure of success, but it's the concern I have is that as I see policies and movements being implemented that really are creating more mental health issues for our students, that is hugely problematic, and that we have lots of things that we need to be working on to support the mental health in our state and beyond. And when those things continue to have people feel less safe, less comfortable talking about their experiences, feeling that services are less accessible, when we have made such progress in being able to make services more accessible, that to me is an area that there's a lot of room to grow and to change that we can all sort of find ways that we can try to make the accessing services and getting help really more accessible for people if we're also addressing those pieces, because that's something that we really are seeing as getting in the way.
Thank you. And I think, Dr. Kushner, we're going to give you the final word on the panel.
Thank you. That's a great honor, actually. With regard to the AI question, I thought it was really nice the way that there were earlier discussions about how AI might be used on the treatment side and on the therapy side. I wanted to also offer that I think there's a lot of interesting work that's in parallel going on using the wealth of information that are in each of our medical records on how to be able to use AI algorithms to sort through that wealth of information to try to build what we call clinical predictors, predictions about outcome, long-term outcome, for instance, for most mental health disorders, there's a tremendous range of outcome, which, medications might be most efficacious, which medications might, be particularly sensitive to, some of the more severe side effects that can plague them from many of the medications that we prescribe, in psychiatry. And that actually, turns to the second point, because I was talking about, building outcome predictors, are what are the right outcomes to use? And I think the question, the way that it was elegantly phrased, was how do we measure success? And I'd like to offer, and I'm borrowing this actually from essentially what the FDA has told us about how to build clinical trials to be able to look at efficacy, for new psychiatric treatments in particular. And that is really, we should increasingly be looking at, I think, in psychiatry and in mental health, real world outcomes. So, historically, in the research domain, we have sort of structured assessments for depression or anxiety or psychosis, and I don't want to minimize those. I think those are really important for those domains. But ultimately, someone scores on a Hamilton rating scale for depression is not going to change their life. What I think we need to focus on is real world, functional outcomes. Basically, to what extent can people be living their full, potential out in life? What is people's life satisfaction? What is the extent to which they're able to, to have paid work that gives them value and meaning in life? To what extent, do they have, a social circle that gives them meaning in life? And trying to develop metrics, I think, that are increasingly reflective of people's life satisfaction is something that I think should be, an increasing focus for all of us. And, that there are some that exist, but I think a lot more attention on that and, how we measure success would be very welcome in the field.
Thank you so much. Let's thank the panel. I also have a few other thank yous. I want to thank the staff in my office who worked on the flyers and the programs for our event. I want to thank Mai Allen especially, who's right up here, who organized everything else. Speaking of that, she hopes that you'll finish off the food in the back before you leave tonight. Please help yourselves. I want to thank Beth, and I want to thank Yvonne for helping organize, and I want to thank the League of Women Voters for co-sponsoring and co-organizing this event. Thank you so much. Finally, I'd like to recognize Gary Papil up here in the front. He met me last November. And I have been in this job only a few months, but I think he was pretty successful in getting this revival of this center at the top of my priority list. So, Gary, thank you. Thank you for all your efforts and dedication to mental health in our community. We have some flowers for you to take home to you, for you and your wife, and we just wanted to say thank you especially. Thank you very much for coming.